Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for spending some of your day with us. We begin the show today by talking with you about landscape lighting. And our guest today is Woody Kerwin. Woody is the owner of Night Owl Landscape Lighting in Waukesha. He's been in the landscape design business and build business for more than 10 years and has attended the International Landscape Lighting Institute's intensive course. Great to have him with us today, and we'll talk with him about the benefits of lighting, landscape lighting. We'll talk about new technologies, how you might best select and position fixtures, and of course, we want to hear from you. What landscape lighting questions do you have for Woody? Have you had some experiences, maybe good, maybe not so good, with landscape lighting? I'd love to hear about those experiences as well. You can join in a couple ways. You can call us. The number's 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Woody Kerwin, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to be here.
How'd you get interested in landscape lighting?
Well, it was a journey that started in 2011 when I got into the green industry in general, working in general landscaping. I was introduced to landscape lighting that year. And while I kind of had a plan to always get into business somewhere in the green industry, once I discovered lighting, it was just, you know, I just completely took off in that direction, and I found a passion for something that, I mean, it's such a niche industry. It's you almost don't know it's there, you know, if you're not a part of, you know, the green industry or the electrical industry. And so I just dived in, learned as much as I could, and took me to where I am now.
Yeah. What do you like best about it?
Probably the best part is meeting clients in the evening after we've completed a project, turning on the lights, walking around with them, and viewing the transformation with them. That's usually the most exciting part of any project.
Yeah, I would bet that. And it was fun to watch I bet you look at the faces of the homeowners when they see that maybe for the first time. It's got to be satisfying.
Yeah, it is. And a lot of people aren't, you know, fully aware of what's possible with a well-designed lighting system. So to see their yard in a completely different way at night all of a sudden, when they're used to just daylight and what might be a beautiful landscape all day, you know, how we design the lights, where we put the lights, what we select to bring out of the darkness really can, you know, have a big emotional impact on people and really change how they view their whole property.
So let's talk about some more the advantages of adding lighting to your landscape. You kind of touched on them in a way, but there are several advantages to adding lighting.
Yeah, that's correct. There's three main things that we focus on: safety, security, and aesthetics. Safety being wayfinding, so pathways and steps, deck steps, areas around a pool. Things that you need lit, so if you have guests or people, kids wandering around at night, they can safely see where they're going without having hazards. So that's the safety part of it. Security, lighting is, you know, there are mixed studies on lighting in general, but it does make people feel safer, and it does deter crime. So that's a big part of it. A lot of people are interested in that aspect of lighting. And then the aesthetics is really making your yard beautiful, and tying all those elements together with good aesthetics is how you have a successful end result of your lighting system.
You know, I would think if you've got a well-lighted landscape, the curb appeal and value of the property should be higher.
Yeah. I would agree with that. We do talk to clients about that quite a bit. And anyone who's gone house shopping, you know, in the last 5 years in particular, you'll see a lot of nighttime photos of properties now on listings. It might just be the house, illuminated, but a well-lit house is a big attraction. And it most certainly makes your property visually more appealing, which adds to value. You know, it's a bit of a subjective value and for some people, but knowing that's already taken care of, if you're moving to a house that has it, to make you feel more secure and to enjoy your yard, is definitely something there.
And I've been to some homes that have been well lighted, the landscape and the ambience of that. I mean, I'm thinking of one in particular, the shadows and the highlights, unique features of a tree, for example, really adds a lot of interest. And that feeling of, boy, this is a really cool place.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. When we start looking at a yard for lighting, we try to identify the focal points and the unique characteristics of that landscape that we want to draw out at night. And you mentioned shadows and darkness. And so contrast is an enormous part of any lighting, particularly in the landscape because it's so dark. But we can select the things that are most important to see at night. And leaving other areas dark really makes those things pop even more. So if you have a cherished tree in your yard that you planted when your kids were young, as an example, or you have garden art or something that gets, it can get a little bit lost in the daytime in a mulch bed, you know, depending on what it looks like. Well, now if we draw that out with some well-placed lighting, you know, good light levels, correct beam angles, all of a sudden the yard looks just completely different, and it really draws people outside if you have backyard patios.
And you know, as I was thinking about this too, with modern LED lighting, I think it's much more energy efficient than maybe 15 years ago, or even less than that ago. And with the color options, that you have with the LED, I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's been a big change in our industry with LED. Definitely much more efficient. I mean, something around 75% more efficient than an old incandescent system. So that's an important part right there. I mean, everything is LED now. There aren't halogen systems going in around here anymore. It just allows you to do so much more. You need so much less power to run a system. And then the LEDs, like you mentioned, with color changing, it opens up that whole door, which is a whole new thing. You can really play around with that stuff. It's a lot of fun. It's not for every yard, but it is a lot of fun, and it can produce some really cool effects and talk about really changing the way your landscape looks.
Yeah. I went on your website at Night Owl Landscaping, and I was looking at some of the color, the things with color you've done with some of the homes. It's really quite spectacular, but you're also right. It was not going to work everywhere.
No, it's not for everyone. Some people like it because it's a holiday lighting shortcut in some ways. If you're already going to put in a lighting system, now it can just be red and green. And now that saves some trouble on the roof. You know, some people have a lot of entertaining and they do private events, and that's a whole other direction to go with possibilities for that. But it's with LEDs in general, not just the color changing part of it, we can pick color temperatures. And that's another level of this where you can pick a cooler white to highlight something that's a green or a blue or a warmer white or an even warmer white for like a bistro lighting type of scenario. So it's very much a flexible medium for us to work with.
What do you think, I've seen some lighting, exterior lighting that I really loved and some that I didn't like at all. What are some common mistakes people make when they go to, you know, light up their landscape?
A lot of times it's intensity. So less is more in landscape lighting. We want subtle And sometimes that's multiple subtle light sources versus what sometimes might happen is someone might install a singular, very bright light source to cover, say, half of the house. And that just looks very commercial. It doesn't look inviting. So in those instances, multiple fixtures, you know, in specific areas with subtler outputs would have created a nicer effect. So we see that a lot. We see a lot of overdone pathway lights where there's just way too many on a walkway. It looks like an airport runway. Those are two of the most common mistakes that you can drive down most any street around here at night. And you'll pick out a couple of those and right away. And once you see it once, you'll start to really, you'll notice it. You'll become a little bit more attuned to what it should be.
I was thinking, if you've got half your, you know, I've seen this where all the lights on one side of a property, and then there's nothing on the other side, and that to me, I thought, why would you do that?
That's a lack of balance. So another part of the design process that, you know, when you start thinking about what do we want to do with this yard, we have to think about balance. We don't want to have that real heavy lighting to just one side. It just at night, the whole thing looks off. It's a very inconsistent scene.
And I'm wondering about fixtures too. If you don't use the right kind of fixture, you might spotlight a path with small spotlights, or maybe you choose something that doesn't look in the end doesn't look good with your home. So there's a lot of different things that go into this.
There really is, and there are a lot of different fixtures. And you know, back to the LED component of this, that has really allowed even more fixture types to be developed because we can make them so small now. We can fit them in such tight spaces. The possibilities are endless. It's knowing what to pick, you know, it's knowing what to select for what you're lighting. Do you need a wash light? Do you need a wide, diffused, soft light on something low or a low wall? Do you need a spotlight that can push a narrow beam angle all the way up a tall column? Knowing which of those to pick is what helps create that light, that scene at night that we're looking for.
Yeah. Do you guys do, does your company do maintenance? Is that one thing that is kind of, you know, if there are lights that aren't working and half are and some are and some aren't, that, and you know, that's probably a maintenance kind of thing. Do you do maintenance work?
Yeah, absolutely. We're pretty big proponents of talking to people about that and why it's so important. It's like anything in your house, any utility or any investment. Only this one lives outside, and in our case in Wisconsin through the four seasons. So the effect will degrade over time if some TLC is not performed. You know, basic stuff like cleaning, straightening, and pruning, and readjusting. All of that is essential to keeping the effects the same way. And then that also, you can stay on top of, you know, LED lamp issues when they come up. We can get ahead of failures, replace things. And sometimes trees always grow for the most part. So if we go to a property we did 5 years ago, we might need to put a higher powered light source into that same fixture to now light a tree that is 10 feet taller. Whereas if we didn't do that, that tree would look poorly lit all of a sudden where it looked great 5 years ago. So keeping up with that really is extremely important in my estimation.
Woody Kerwin, our guest, he is the owner of Night Owl Landscaping Lighting, and it's great to have him with us today. Love to have you join in. Questions or maybe an experience to share for yourself or maybe the neighbors, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. 1234, or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today for Garden Talk. Today we are starting the show by taking a look at landscape lighting with our guest Woody Kerwin. Woody is the owner of Night Owl Landscaping Lighting. It's great to have him with us. You can join in with your questions. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. I just want to chime in with a quick thanks to everybody who donated during our year-end member drive. With your help, we received over 2,000 donations, and we had support from people like Kelly and McFarland or Jim and Jane in Madison to help make this possible. If you missed the member drive, there's still time to join in with your gift. Go to WPR.org. Certainly now more than ever, you play a very important role in keeping Wisconsin informed, inspired, and connected. So thank you for helping us keep WPR strong together. As we visit with Woody Kerwin about landscaping and lighting, and again, you can join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Will emailed, and you kind of mentioned this earlier, but landscape lighting in terms of wondering about, does it really deter home break-ins?
Well, I can't speak exactly to that, but there have been a lot of studies have been done on this, I will say that, and some of them point aggressively towards yes, and most of these studies are done for municipalities for lighting streets, lighting parks, parking lots, areas like that. And then on the other side, they've also found studies that say, well, this, if you overlight a space, for an example, and you have a lot of glare from, let's say, a street light that is very bright, glare creates contrast. That's such a bright spot in your eye. All the spaces around it all of a sudden feel darker. And in those instances, well, now all of a sudden it doesn't feel the same way. So from what I've gathered from all the studies that have been done, it can go either way, but the general feeling is people feel more secure with lighting around, and that's important too. And some lighting in areas around the home is certainly better than none, in my opinion.
What I was, somebody, Amy in Sheboygan County called to remind people to be courteous to neighbors when using lighting. And well, maybe you can comment on that. At one point, I had a neighbor whose garage, the light above the garage door, the first night I moved into the house at night, I was in my second story bedroom, and it was like suddenly my whole bedroom was lit up by the neighbor's light. And it was one of these motion sensor lights, so anytime a raccoon or something walked through in the night, the place lit up again.
Yeah, so light trespass is a very important thing to be aware of. A lot of the offenders of light trespass are, like you just said, floodlights on houses that are pointing out across your yard, into your neighbor's space, post lights, coach lights that are omnidirectional. So they're open glass, they're throwing light in all directions. A well-designed landscape lighting system, and they are not all well-designed, will use properly shielded fixtures so you can rotate those shields to cut off light from the directions you don't want it. So if the fixtures are thoughtful and specified correctly, that is almost a non-issue, but there is a lot more lighting out there that's either landscape or on your house that does not fall into that category, that has not been thoughtful in that way. And those are very common things we hear from customers and potential customers that we are always aware of.
Yeah, I would think so. And she also wondered, how long should lights be left on? You know, they don't have to be on all the time. And I guess what's the timing on lighting for night?
It's up to the individual, but the majority of folks will want it to go off when they go to bed. So that's somewhere between 10 and midnight in many instances. Some people want it on all night, and that might be a security concern. I believe it should go off when you go to bed, but if you do want certain zones on, there are all sorts of lighting controls available that we can set things up so that maybe only a subtle amount of light is still on your front walkway or at the front of your door or something like that. You can isolate those zones and control them separately with all of the available technology we use now, so that you could, if you had a security concern and it just made you feel safer, you could still accomplish that without leaving your whole yard lit up from sunset to sunrise.
I'm wondering about those controls. I mean, how how tech conscious do you need to be to operate those controls?
There is a pretty wide variety of ways to control a system, from a basic timer, which runs everything from whatever time you want it on to whatever time you want it off, to manual controls like a dimmer, like you might have on the wall in your house. You can dim certain elements, certain zones of your yard like that. But more commonly nowadays, it's done through Wi-Fi, and multiple manufacturers have different product lines with different apps, but you can, in the best cases, you can separate out each individual fixture in your yard, and on some of these systems can be controlled separately. So you can group it up with like all your tree lights in the backyard, for example, could be one zone. You could dim them all together. You could time them all separately so they shut off at midnight, but maybe your path lights around the patio stay on until sunrise if you like. And you could even dim those down to say 50% and then leave them on for the rest of the night. But those apps, you know, to answer that question, they do get a little bit, you know, there's a learning curve to anything like that with technology nowadays. And it's, you know, something we support, of course, but we teach people how to do these things. There's videos online, there's ways to learn this stuff, and it's very beneficial if you have concerns about, you know, not wanting to overlight, not wanting to be a bug to your neighbors.
Is there something where I could push one button and the lights dim in the back and they dim in the front, but not as much? I'm talking about a preset there.
Yes, there are also preset ways you can do that. A lot of that will come through, like, if you have a home automation system, which isn't our specialty, but it runs a lot of our lighting systems. If your home already has those types of controls for the lighting inside of your house, like a Lutron system is an example, and you have a pad on your wall where you just push a button to hit those light levels inside, you can do that. You can transfer that to your outside lighting exactly as you described. Push a button and boom, the preset takes everything to 50% in the backyard.
That is nice. Bill emailed, do cities or towns have rules, regulations on how much or how bright outdoor lighting can be?
They do, and they are becoming more and more common around the country. So dark sky regulations, as they're often known, will set limits on light output to a property. So maximum amount of lumens, types of fixtures. And again, a lot of those offenders turn out to be coach lights and post lights that are throwing omnidirectional light into your neighbor's yard. But there is a growing concern about dark sky and sky glow at night. And a lot of those rules end up, we have to work with those rules in a lot of neighborhoods. Madison has, like Sherwood Hills has a pretty tight dark sky rule set. But a lot of the problem is municipality lighting and commercial lighting. That is where you're talking 20 to 30,000 lumen fixtures with really high color temperatures, like daylight LEDs reflecting off concrete, bouncing into the sky. I mean, that is where a lot of the concern originates. But on a local, smaller level, it is the light trespass. Neighbors don't want that floodlight in their bedroom window at night, and they want to make sure you're following the rules and keeping everybody happy.
Carrie in Cronenwetter emailed about concerns on how outdoor lighting affects plants and wildlife's natural environments. She wonders if there's ways to address that, or how do you address that?
Another great point. And that's why I'm a proponent of when you go to bed, your lights turn off, because there are there are birds, there are insects, creatures live in some of the trees that we light and in the yards that we're lighting, and they need rest too. So I think it's just a good practice to, you know, if for the majority of your landscape, to not have it running for the entire night, if possible, to be cognizant of those types of things. Plant material, there are certain evergreens that we've seen that if they're under other stress and if they have lights on them, we've seen defoliation very few times, and this is something we have looked into. So if you're lighting up a tree, when you get to kind of later in the year when a tree's trying to go dormant, it might think daylight is extended beyond what it actually is, and it may go dormant later, making it susceptible to potential frost or something like this. And so we do have to be thoughtful about that too. It's a very rare occurrence, but it is something that has been seen, and is something we have to talk to customers about.
Talking today with Woody Kerwin, and Woody is owner of Night Owl Landscaping Lighting. Great to have him with us today, and we'll invite you to join in. We've got some good emails here, and you can call if you'd like to. Number to call, 800-642-1234. But if you'd like, you could also post an email to talk@wpr.org. What does your landscape lighting look like? How might you get it improved, or what do you think about the neighbors? We've heard a few of those comments already. 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. I'm wondering, what should people look for when selecting a lighting company? I mean, there are lots of them out there, not a huge number, but quite a few lighting companies. And if I'm looking for one, what do I look for?
Well, the first thing you should look at is their portfolio. Look at their work. See what they've done in the past. How do they treat light? You know, what is important, you know, to that company? How are they going to make your yard look? So the portfolio will give you a lot of those clues right away. And then I'd say, like anytime you're hiring a contractor to do anything, you know, maybe talk to more than one and see what other ideas, you know, one might have versus another. Design is, you know, people have different design philosophies. They may choose to do different things or suggest different things with your yard. And you want to make sure you're getting someone who's listening to you and what you want to accomplish with your lights and make a decision that way. So that is how I approach when I'm having work done. I want to see what the viewpoints are. I suggest people do the same thing. It's make a well-rounded decision.
Well, I think you're based basically in Waukesha, but you work in other areas as well.
Correct. Yeah, we do. Yep. We work in Madison. We work all of Southeast Wisconsin. We do travel. It's a very specialty industry, so we do travel.
Yeah. Mary Ann is wondering if you need to adjust or worry about landscape lighting during the cold winter and maybe snowy months.
It is a great question because with LED, we now have fixtures that aren't as hot, which is a bonus. If you have lights on your desk, on your deck, and they were halogen, they could be extremely hot and someone could bump those and burn their hand, and now they are not. Now they're 70, 80 degrees running temperatures. But in the wintertime, a little bit less than that. So the big thing in winter with landscape lighting in terms of maintenance is heavy snowfall. LEDs will still warm up enough to melt off snow, but it will take time. And if you get, you know, a 10, 12 inch snowfall, you may have to, you know, by the time you're done addressing all the other things on your property of getting the snow out of the way and you remember you have lights, you might have to go brush them off because they may take a little longer than you'd like to get through that amount of snow.
And the outdoor, I assume the way they're made or manufactured or put together, they're gonna deal with snow events. Obviously, they got to deal with rain events too, but...
Absolutely. High quality fixtures, which are extremely important to the longevity of the system, are going to be weatherproof. They are going to be watertight. So just like the rain, they will be okay with the snow.
You also install outdoor audio. That's changed a lot over the years. When I did I had some, the builder I was working with or the remodeler said, oh, you ought to install some attachments outside so you can hook up your audio if you want to. Well, so I've got some holes in the wall and some wire hanging out that I will never use or have to use.
Yeah, those, and that is the traditional outdoor audio is a couple of speakers on the, you know, back of your house over your patio, your deck, whatever it is. Now we do outdoor surround sound system. So it's opened up it's basically taking hi-fi audio outdoors, which was very difficult to do because inside your audio systems have walls to reverberate against you, and outside is just open space. So the sound travels and it doesn't get captured the same way. So using surround systems with multiple smaller speakers and even subwoofers, subterranean subwoofers that get in those low frequencies that are very hard to, they're easy to get inside with walls, but are harder to replicate outdoors. Once you incorporate something like that into a surround sound audio system, it's definitely an excellent addition to, you know, a really nice landscape, another enhancement that you can do to use it more and enjoy it more.
Wow, surround sound. So you've got, where do these speakers, I mean, is there one behind the rose bush? And when, what would something like that look like?
You got it. So if you had a patio, you know, you might have, you know, a medium-sized patio, you might have eight smaller bullet-shaped speakers, these smaller speakers kind of evenly spaced all around the patio, directed in towards the patio, so the sound is all focused. And we can hide them behind rose bushes and perennials and whatever else and try to keep them tucked out of the way. If a lot of resorts have been doing things like this, where they'll have it, you know, around the pool at a resort, you'll see individual speakers kind of spaced all around so that if you're hanging out around the pool, you can hear the music evenly everywhere without having to have it turned up so loud you can't talk over it. So a good surround audio system gives you that effect of everybody hears everything well, it's clear, it's nice, but you can still talk and have, you know, conversations.
And the cost on that sort of thing has come down quite a bit, I think.
Those systems, I wouldn't say that they're they're somewhat new in the sense of maybe the last 10, 15 years they've become more popular. And so now there are more options in the marketplace, which, yes, that does drive costs.
Yeah, for sure. Let's see, we've got Louise with an email. What impact does landscape lighting have on my electric bill?
Well, depends on the size of the system, of course, and how long you run it. If you run it for, you know, if you set it to turn on at sunset and off at, just say, midnight, you know, those hours change throughout the year, so you add that up. With LED, most systems we install are running off of a 300-watt transformer, which is rarely ever fully loaded. So let's say 200 watts. Compare that to, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you've got four incandescent 50-watt lamps in your house. That's the equivalent of four of those lamps running. And you might have 30 to 40 light fixtures in your yard running. So it's a blip on the bill nowadays is the best way to put it, unless you've got a 10-acre property and you really went all out.
George email, can you describe what do you mean by wet rated fixtures? Are there different ratings that make some fixtures less susceptible to water damage than others?
Yeah, great question. So there is a rating system, IP rating system. So IP68, for example, is waterproof. And then 67, 66, you go down that list and they test these fixtures against driving rain from different directions in order to achieve those ratings. Those are also dust ingress ratings, so how much dirt and whatever else can draw into there. So depending on what you're doing if you're lighting a water feature, you obviously would need an IP68 rated submersible fixture. If you're just putting up lights in a mulch bed, you don't need a fixture that watertight, but you still need it to resist driving rain or irrigation systems. Many of the properties we work on have irrigation, which water coming horizontally from whatever direction. Yeah. And you don't want that to get in there either. So, you know, a properly designed system will have all of that there in mind.
Mark is wondering, what should he budget for lighting a small patio? He's got a small patio attached to his house and a path that goes around the house. So you got a path, and it's, I mean, I'm not here seeing the size of the patio or the length of the path, but assuming sort of a standard house in the city of Madison, you might have something, maybe a porch that's 12, 15 feet maybe, or 20 feet across, would be probably fairly common.
Sure. Yeah. And every property, of course, is different and every system is designed to it. But knowing, you know, budget numbers are important. So if you're installing a professionally designed lighting system, you should expect that to start around $2,500. Which is going to get your power supply and your timer, whatever you decide to do for control, and a handful of fixtures depending on the type. And then building upon that, an average lighting system for a front or backyard, if it's relatively comprehensive, is going to be somewhere between, you know, $4,000 and $7,000 a side if you're doing sort of a standard warm white system, not getting into the bells and the whistles of color changing, and high-tech controls and things like that.
Joanne emailed to ask to say her dog likes to dig. should she be concerned with digging up wires from the lighting?
Well, a number of concerns with dogs digging in the garden, for sure. Your bulbs, all sorts of things might come up. It shouldn't damage wiring, but what dogs dig, we see them dig against foundations of houses a lot, and a lot of wiring should be run along foundations. So it's, you know, so if you ever renovated your garden beds and wanted to change out your perennials or bushes or whatever, you don't have wires running willy-nilly through the mulch bed. So we do see them dig against foundations. They do expose wiring. If you've got a dog that likes to chew on wiring, you might have other problems as well, but more commonly we see pests, you know, other rodents that are actually causing damage to wire.
Oh, man. I tell you what. Woody Kerwin, our guest today, is the owner of Night Owl Landscaping Lighting. It works based in Waukesha, but works around southern Wisconsin, many places, including Madison and others as well. Questions or comments or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at outdoor landscape lighting today with our guest, Woody Kerwin. It's great to have him with us. Coming up at the top of the hour today, we'll be looking at some other things. The second hour of the show, we'll check in with the Savannah Institute about ways to grow perennial foods, including black currants, so, among other things. And black currants, by the way, are the 2026 flavor of the year. So I want to find out why that's so. But anyway, right now, if you've got a lighting experience or a lighting question you want to share, I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Tom emailed, what's the possible impact of installing landscape lighting on my yard? Do installers, I mean, what does it look like? I mean, any damage or whatever that might occur to the sod or the trees or whatever, I assume the installers, well, what do you do in this in terms of
Yeah, that's a great question. One we get asked regularly. So everything we do is low voltage. So low voltage has different rules than, say, your 120 volt house power, which, let's say that you were running that around your yard, you'd have to trench in 12, 18 inch deep conduits and really make a mess of the yard. We're able to install everything low voltage with hand tools, essentially. So we get down, you know, 6-7 inches everywhere we go, but we can work around perennials. We can use sort of flat blade trenching tools to split your turf open, get the wire down 7 inches, and then tamp that shut. And you've just got, you know, in the middle of summer, you might have a little yellow seam across your lawn. If we had to cross the lawn somewhere, that will, you know, heal up all on its own. But we are very, it's very important to us that your landscape looks just like it did when we, you know, show up. By the time we're done, you should just have a beautiful landscape lighting system, and you should not know we were there. The landscape should look excellent.
Okay. You know, I went on, I looked at your photo array, and it's really, really some beautiful work. One of the areas that kind of struck me was art and sculpture outside. And that to me, I mean, those were very dramatic in their own way. I mean, they weren't big splashy lights or anything, but the lighting on the face of a piece of sculpture that you had, you know, and the shadows that were created were just beautiful.
It's definitely one of my favorite things to work with is a garden that has a lot of unique art and other things like that. Those are, you know, often become our focal points in a lighting scene. And we don't want to necessarily overlay them. Like you say, there's shadowing, there's texture from shadow. So to show some shadowing is an important part of any lighting design, because it helps define the light even better. It helps define what you're lighting. And so when we come across a yard that has a bunch of custom art or something really cool or something that's just really special to a homeowner, and being able to bring that out of the dark for them and make that just more of a focal point at night is always very special. We do love working with that.
Even your eyes light up when you see an opportunity like that, I bet.
We can work with what you have, essentially. You know, the canvas that you present is what we paint with light. You know, it's said in our industry a lot is we paint with light. And so what you have is what we can work with.
Jennifer emailed, how far apart should outdoor fixtures should they be from each other? I'm assuming she may be thinking about a walkway, but maybe not.
I would assume so. That is typically where those rules will come into play. And there are some factors with that, such as how wide of a throw does the path light have? How much space does it cover? But our general rule of thumb is 12 to 18 feet, depending on the walkway, depending on how well traveled it is. You know, a lot of things we see now with front yards, they have a walkway to their front door, but most people just drive into the garage and they go right into the garage. So that front walkway, unless you're entertaining or keeping the lights on for the delivery guys, they don't get used all that often. So we don't have to overdo that, and never want to overdo path lights. That always makes a landscape look too busy, even during the day. You have path lights here and there, you know, too many is too many, and you know it when you see it. So I would say 15 feet is a very good rule, and then plus or minus, depending.
Do you use solar lighting at all? I see, you know, you can buy solar lights for walkways, for example.
We do not. There are no great solar options in an individual fixture. The panels are too small. The batteries that store the power are too small. The light output is too low. Wisconsin isn't a phenomenal area in general for solar, you know, compared to Southwest. So at certain times of year, you're getting almost nothing out of those lights, and the construction of them, plastic, things like that. Unfortunately, they are still kind of a throwaway thing. They're a nice kind of stopgap, and sometimes it's all the budget allows for, but we only do wired systems.
David emailed to ask, what kinds of lighting would you suggest for a historic house and garden?
So we have to be pretty careful with those. So a lot of times that, you know, we'll want to pick fixtures that have a material that is consistent with, you know, a property like that. Like if it's an old stone house in Wauwatosa, for example, that's a historic house, you know, natural metals are important. Using like a copper fixture that's going to patina and look like what might be some copper gutters or something on their house. So fixture style is important in those aspects to me. And then just being tasteful with anything historic, you know, not overdoing something, you know, making sure you're showing a true rendering of something like that. Not getting carried away and over lighting, things like that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. How long does a project take from start to finish for your company, from talking to the people and so forth, and the lighted end, let's put it that way.
Yeah, so the consultation process where we meet people and find out, you know, why do they want light? What is it for? And then putting together a plan can take, you know, a few days. Installations vary. A lot of projects are done in a day on a typical sized house if we're just doing one side of the property. And then really big projects can stretch to multiple weeks. But the vast majority of median sized homes, you know, are done in 1 to 2 days. Say that pretty safely.
Yeah. Do you do them at, you know, even this time of the year when we've got some cold weather outside and harder because you may have frozen, you can't work with frozen ground, I don't imagine.
Yeah, you're right. Usually when the frost gets below about an inch or two, that's when we call it a season. This year we got stopped a little bit early with all that early snow, but that also did serve to insulate the ground. So underneath the snow, shoveling it away, it was still soft. So Christmas is a good, typically every year we're working up to Christmas Eve.
Jim and Cable has a comment. Hi, Jim.
Hi. We had a challenge. I heard an earlier caller ask about historic lighting for historic houses. I was on a board that restored Orchard Lawn in Mineral Point, which is an 1868 Victorian house. And we needed exterior lighting because we had nighttime events. And for safety and whatnot, we didn't want to introduce any new aspects into the landscape that weren't there historically. So what we wound up doing was tree lighting, lighting from inside the canopy of the tree that shined down onto the driveway and picked up the shadows of the lower branches. And we matched the color temperature to moonlight.
Oh.
As you walked down the driveway, it looked like there was a full moon, and you saw the shadows of the branches on the driveway.
Oh, man.
And it was
man.
Just magical.
Oh, man, Jim, that sounds great. And you're nodding in agreement on that one, Woody.
Moonlighting is one of my favorite effects. We do a lot of moonlighting, a lot of downlighting from trees. It's just it's a natural way that you see light naturally coming from above, of course, during the day. So it's a great way to tie in lighting on the ground plane with all, you know, the other uplighting that may go on with the property. It really creates a great flow, and the dappled sort of moonlight effect you can get from shining down through branches is magical, like he says.
Oh, that is very cool. Jim, thank you very much for calling. And Woody, thank you so much for taking an hour of your time to be with us and talk about landscape lighting. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no, thank you. It's certainly been a pleasure. I appreciate it.
Woody Kerwin is the owner of Night Owl Landscaping Lighting, and he's got a really nice site online that with a lot of wonderful photos of the work that they have done, or that he and his crew have done. Great to have him with us. Coming up, we're going to change direction quite a bit, and we'll be talking with some folks about from the Savannah Institute, and we'll be talking about nuts and berries and a whole lot more. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mealer here. We're going to turn our attention now to growing and using perennial food crops. And we've got a couple of guests from the Savannah Institute. Jacob Grace, the Communication Project Manager, and Lily Hislop, the black currant and elderberry breeder for the Savannah Institute. Jacob has a master's degrees in two areas, one agroecology and the other actually from my home academic department, Life Sciences Communication at the UW-Madison. Jacob, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be back, Larry.
Yeah, it's good to have you back. Lily has a PhD from UW-Madison in plant breeding and in plant genetics. She's worked with a variety of species, including things like sweet corn, pumpkin, miscanthus, teosinte, Lily, a lot of things. And I'm going to be talking with you about some of those things, but welcome to the show again. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Larry. Happy to be here.
So as we talk with our guests, I hope you join in. What would you like to know about adding perennial fruit crops to your landscape, your garden? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Jacob, first, refresh us on what the Savannah Institute does and maybe how it got started and what's going on with it.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So the Savannah Institute is a nonprofit organization. We're about 10 years old now, and we do most of our work is related to agroforestry, which I'm sure we'll talk about more. So that's anything involving trees or woody plants on farms, and it's a type of perennial agriculture, which is farming with perennial plants. We'll be talking a lot more about that too. But we're a relatively young organization, and a lot of our work is kind of in the southern Wisconsin and north central Illinois area. We're now managing some demonstration farms near Spring Green, Wisconsin, also kind of near central Illinois, and we're really trying to do kind of the research and development and demonstration to figure out what it takes to grow these perennial tree crops here in the Midwest, and to do so in a way that is profitable for farmers and can also have benefits for the land and the soil and water quality and some of these other things we really care about in this part of the country.
Yeah. What are the crops that you grow at the Institute?
Yeah, we grow a lot of different types of tree crops, but some of the ones that we're really interested in are crops that can serve multiple purposes. So these are things that you can raise for the fruits and the nuts off the trees themselves, but that they can also do other things like provide wildlife habitat, provide windbreaks, provide shelter for livestock. So we're really interested in some of these multi-purpose crops. And some of the ones that we've kind of zeroed in on a little bit are nut trees like chestnuts and hazelnuts. We're interested in some berry crops like black currants and elderberries, which is Lily's specialty. And then we're interested in persimmons, which is a really nutritious and delicious fruit that can grow here in the Midwest. And a number of other crops that we're working with too, but those are some of kind of the ones we talk about the most, I would say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Lily, how'd you get interested in this business of perennial growing and farming?
For a long time, I love food. I'm a big food fan, a big flavor fan, and I love working with plants and sciences. And to find this intersection of I can focus on flavor while working with plants and having a combination of inside-outside work and seeing large-scale results happening is really rewarding. So to find a job that allows me to do that, especially in a nonprofit where I can be working on like restorative agriculture, it's just a dream come true.
Oh, it sure sounds like it when I hear you talk. And, you know, you've got this interesting background. I think I mentioned in the introduction, you've worked with sweet corn and pumpkin, miscanthus and teosinte. Miscanthus, teosinte are probably two that may be less well-known to our gardening community. Let's talk miscanthus. It's a kind of a high yield perennial grass, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I started in undergrad looking at biological sciences and wanting to do plant sciences in general. So my miscanthus work was in my undergrad, and I was looking at genes that control flowering time in miscanthus. And miscanthus in this context is a grass that we grow for biofuels. It's a quick growing perennial grass that produces a lot of biomass. And then I did some work looking at tropical seeds and how tropical seeds interact with fungi in like collaborative, mutualistic ways. I did some research on pumpkins and pumpkin diseases. Specifically, there's a bacteria called Xanthomonas cucurbitae that makes pumpkins rot, and it's just the smelliest job. It was interesting, but it was so smelly.
Yeah, had to take a bath and wash the clothes when you got done with that.
Oh my God, you're getting the bacterial cultures, trying to pick it up, and then you're just injecting it into leaves. And then my PhD work was on sweet corn, specifically on the sugars and carbohydrates on sweet corn, and looking for genetic markers that align with different levels of sweetnesses. And I had a little bitty side project trying to make a perennial sweet corn. And sweet corn is not perennial, neither is regular corn, right? We lost that when we domesticated sweet corn. So teosinte is the ancestor that corn was domesticated from. So trying to make a perennial sweet corn, I was crossing back to teosinte and getting those perennial genes back into the corn. And luckily at the Savannah Institute, I can have that be a teeny part of my job, a little bit, as a fun side project.
Well, you know, and I, if you look at the corn, that corn itself, that teosinte, it's kind of, it's pretty cool looking. The kernels, if I'm not mistaken, they're a harder kernel. I mean, they were used, have been used as a food source, certainly.
The domestication occurred about 8,000 years in the Balsa River Valley of Mexico, and the archaeological evidence suggests that they were using teosinte as a food source, primarily as a popped corn. They're tiny and they're hard, and they are covered in this really hard seed coat that kind of looks like puppy teeth or like tiny hooves. But if you throw them in a fire, they can pop. And so that's how they started eating them in the first place.
Well, they ground them, I think, too. And you could boil them, I imagine, too.
Yeah, and if you really spend a lot of time grinding, you can get through that seed coat.
Yeah, you want some sort of electric grinder for that, maybe. I don't know. Jacob, why do farms need to be more resilient?
Well, that's a big question, and there are a lot of reasons for that. But when we talk about agroforestry and talk about some of these crops that Lily is working with, we kind of think of agroforestry as this thing that can be a solution to a lot of different challenges at once. So farmers are dealing with a lot of different challenges in our area, with profitability and farm viability being a big one, but also just dealing with things like flooding events, less predictable weather. If, you know, we're the dairy state and a lot of farmers are trying to find ways to increase milk production, increase animal comfort so that they can have better milk production. And it's fun for me working for the Savannah Institute to hear the different reasons that people come to us interested in agroforestry. And there are a lot of different reasons that people kind of find us and find our work. And it can be everything from wanting a new crop that might be a new source of income, working with one of these up and coming crops, to maybe they have a system that they're very happy with, but they have one problem they're trying to solve, like trying to reduce their wind erosion or trying to slow down the water that's flowing off their land, trying to provide more comfort for their livestock, something like that. So, you know, we say a lot that agroforestry can look a different way on every single farm. It's very flexible. It can look a lot of different ways. It's going to look different in Wisconsin than it would in Iowa or in Illinois. And I think that's a good thing, is that it can really be adapted to whatever someone's needs are and what their challenges might be.
Yeah. And as we move along, I'm thinking about home gardeners now, and a lot of the things that you're talking about, home gardeners could have on their own property as well.
That's exactly right. And one of the things that we were talking about as we were getting ready for this is that I know people ask about perennial crops or agroforestry crops that they can grow in their backyard as opposed to growing on a farm. And I think that some of the crops that Lily works with, like these elderberries and black currants, some of these bushier berry crops are really a good fit for home gardening.
And Lily McCormick just revealed that the black currant is its flavor of the year.
Oh, it's so exciting.
Yeah, how's that going to affect your work?
Oh, I'm stoked about it. So
you've hit the big time, Lily.
I have. It's what a great stroke of luck. We have not worked with McCormick in any capacity. We're hoping to work with them this year, but this is a surprise to us, too. So black currant is a really unfamiliar flavor in the United States. The primary reason for that is we had a federal ban against all black currants and their larger genus Ribes for 55 years in the United States, starting from 1911 to 1966. And that's because they are a host for a fungus that is a little inconvenient for currant plants, but kills pine trees. It's called white pine blister rust. And during the when this disease first was brought to the U.S., pine was the big industry in the Northeast. They had reforested basically all of New England with white pines because it was really cheap, and there weren't many tariffs on the importation of seedlings. And so the government chose to focus on the pine investment and get rid of the black currant plants. And they did that by employing war internees and the Civilian Conservation Corps and high schoolers. And they just sent tens of thousands of people out into the forests of the United States to get rid of all the Ribes plants they could find. And that includes both black currant, which is it's a European variety, it's a European species, and that includes all the native varieties. We have maybe 27 species of Ribes plants native to the North American region. And so around that time was also when we were like inventing mass-produced candies and flavors and jellos and sodas. And the flavors that they were developing at that time were what they had available in terms of ingredient. So black currant wasn't around as an ingredient. And so we just missed the boat on having it enter our like flavor lexicon as far as Americans go. So for example, in Skittles, the green Skittle is lime or green apple or whatever, and the yellow Skittle is lemon. And in America, the purple Skittle is grape. And in the UK, the purple Skittle is black currant, right? So like other places have a familiarity with this flavor and we don't. So I'm so excited for Americans to like have this prompting of, what is this plant? I've never heard of it. How do I try and eat it? And what does it taste like?
You know, I don't know what you think about the taste. Somebody said, well, it tastes to me like a strong blackberry mixed with a dark grape.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I would describe it as a blackberry and pine. It has a like deep berry flavor and also a little bit of a like sulfuric, interesting component that really adds a depth to it. I think it's absolutely the best jam you can get.
Yeah, I think so. Cheryl in Bessemer, Michigan has something to add right to this conversation here. Let's go there. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, Larry. It's me calling about wine again. My boyfriend, we moved all these blackcurrant plants from this farm, and they went nuts in my backyard. And my boyfriend makes the best wine out of it. Well, he makes all kinds of wine. He makes the best wine out of it, and it'll kick your butt, believe me. It would. I'll tell you what, I'm tempted to get a little still and make it into a brandy. It is so good, but you have to be careful. because it comes out a lot stronger.
That sounds delicious.
Blackcurrant wine. There, well, you can start experimenting with that, Lily.
Absolutely. I do cassis, and it's one of the ways that I compare different cultivars of the black currants I'm breeding is to make it into a creme de cassis, which is, you know, infused vodka, basically.
How does, how black currants certainly grow well here in Wisconsin. If, you know, Cheryl's growing them in Bessemer, Michigan, they ought to work well here for anybody who wanted to put some in their backyard.
Yeah, they do really well. They are mainly limited by heat, not by cold. They can get as cold as you like, basically, negative 50 Fahrenheit. They just don't like being above 100 for very long if you can avoid it. So they do really well in full sun. They do well in partial shade, and especially if you're looking at red currants, which is a different species, but also a very similar bush architecture. Those almost yield better in the shade because they're a forest crop and they're a forest plant. They need a pretty normal pH between like 5 and 7 or 8. They're pretty tolerant in that. They don't super mind having wet feet. They'd rather not, but...
They'd rather not. But, all right, so you're telling me practically, well, not everywhere in Wisconsin, but in a good share of Wisconsin, you could grow them. That'd be fun to have.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, could you have access? The thing is, and Jacob, you probably know this, the access to the plants might be an issue.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And that's part of why our organization exists, is to try to help scale up some of these crops that we're working with. So Lily's involved in that work. We're doing some of that work on our farms. And we also have a kind of a sister organization called Canopy Farm Management, which is has a nursery business. So that's not a nonprofit. That's a nursery business that is trying to make some of these crops available for people. And Lily's been working to get some of the blackcurrant varieties that she works with out into other nurseries across the state as well.
Yeah. So we have two blackcurrant varieties that we have released to retail nurseries this year. They're called Savannah Zing and Savannah Zap. They're both really delicious. They're both high-yielding plants that work great in a home garden. And you can get those from Canopy Nursery. And we have another number of retail nurseries, such as One Green World, that are going to start stocking it. And I'm trying to get it into more nurseries as well. So if you have a home nursery or a nearby place that sells bush plants and you want them to stock Savannah Zing and Savannah Zap, have them email me.
Yeah, you're ready and willing to help out there with that. I'm thinking it'd be fun to have, not only is this, I mean, for farms, it could be wonderful. For the home gardener, too, you're looking at, I mean, what's a plant going to produce? Maybe 10 pounds? I don't know. I have no idea.
It depends on how close you plant them together. But a plant, a black currant plant, you can get between 2 pounds and 10 pounds of fruit per bush. If you give it more space, it'll produce more fruit. If you prune it well, it'll produce more fruit. And if you give it the fertilizer it needs, it'll produce more.
And I'm thinking from a sales standpoint or just from your own home use, I mean, black currants are, if I'm not mistaken, very high in vitamin C. They contain... Do they contain antioxidants as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My personal saying is that the healthiest berry for you is the one you're willing to eat. And yeah. If you find a black currant variety you like, then they're delicious and they're great for you.
Karen in Kewanee has something. Let's go there. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I'm glad to talk to you. Very interesting program. I have been planting a lot of these bushes for well over 30 years. I have over 50 of them, from aronia, goji berries, black, red currants, yasta berries, all of it. I plant all of these in tires, So I can go around them with the weed whacker or lawnmower without injuring the plants. And I also pack rabbit manure inside the tires, so kind of as a mulch. But also domesticated rabbit manure will repel wild rabbits from chewing on these plants in winter. A comment about the black currants, they are very good for diabetics. I don't know if you're aware of that. The leaves make fantastic tea, and it is a taste that you have to acquire. I pick these. I put them in bags in the freezer. They go in my yogurt, my smoothies, my oatmeal in the morning. But all of these berries are very good for you. But just a comment I wanted to make. Also, when I make sweet breads, I substitute like black currants and red currants for cranberries. They make the most delicious sweet breads, especially around the holidays.
Oh, Karen, what a salesperson. You need about another million people just like her here in the state.
Yeah, I learned some things there.
Well, you always learn something here on Garden Talk.
That's true.
Two guests for you today, Jacob Grace and Lily Hislop. They are both with the Savannah Institute, and we're talking with them today. It's great to have them with us. And you can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining us today on Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Big thanks to everybody who donated during our year-end member drive. Support from people like Renee in Watertown or Pat in Milwaukee have really helped make our service possible. If you missed the drive, still time to join in with your gift at WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Right now, we're talking with Jacob Grace and also with Lily Hislop, both with the Savannah Institute. And we're taking a look at the latest of their work on growing perennial foods. And we've got tree crops, and plants, bush plants. We've been talking a lot about black currants. But others as well, and glad to have you listening in, and certainly feel free to join in. You know, we haven't mentioned the nuts. We're nuts. kind of yes. nutty myself, but the nut crops, the ones that you're studying, Jacob, are, just to get that into the mix here.
Yeah, thanks for bringing those back. Two of the ones we talk a lot about are chestnuts and hazelnuts. Those are both nut crops that grow pretty well in our part of the world. And sometimes we describe these as corn on trees and soybeans on trees. So chestnuts are these kind of similar to corn in some ways. They're very starchy and sweet, and are, as some of our farmers say, everything likes to eat chestnuts. Humans, deer, raccoons, anything that can find a chestnut will eat it. They're just really delicious, and they can be added to a lot of things, kind of as you would use some of these things like corn. And then hazelnuts are a very oil-rich crop, and so people might be familiar with hazelnut oil, and it can kind of serve some of the same purposes in that regard, too. We're excited about hazelnuts because they can be grown in a bit more of a shrub form that we're starting to harvest them with machines, which is kind of one of the big bottlenecks to a lot of these crops, is going from harvesting them by hand to being able to harvest them more efficiently with machinery. So those are two that we're looking at a lot. And something I was thinking about during the break with the last caller who was talking about black currants, but also some of these other berry crops like elderberries or like aronia berries. It reminded me of something that Lily told me actually when I was interviewing her for our podcast that we produce from the Savannah Institute. And Lily was saying that we're used to being able to eat berries raw. And so a lot of our most common berries, like strawberries and blueberries, you get them at the store and you just pop them right in your mouth. And some of these berries that we're working with, like black currants or aronia berries, They're really healthy. They're really nutritious, but eating them raw is not necessarily giving them their opportunity to shine. So it was nice to hear from the first caller who's doing some making the blackcurrant wine. I know Lily's working with different things you can do with these berries, but that was kind of a something that I learned from Lily, is that if you really want to make the most of some of these berry crops, you might want to make them into jam or jelly or something other than just eating them raw, because that's what we're used to, but that's not necessarily when they're at their best.
I'm not a big fan of persimmons raw.
Right. You got to be careful. If you get a good persimmon, it's delicious. But if you get it too early, it's like eating a cotton ball. Yeah.
Well, we got all of our lines are filled. Dwayne in River Falls, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Dwayne.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I planted a few three blackcurrant bushes a couple years ago, and I've been trying over the last several years to turn my landscape into edible, urban, type of thing.
Yeah.
But it's, and the first year I got like maybe a pint of berries. Now, this last year I got enough for a batch of jam and a batch of cassis. I'm hoping next year I get a batch of wine out of it. But I do have another question about the nut trees. How good is a butternut for an urban tree?
Ooh, how good is a butternut for an urban tree? That's a great question. I'm not super familiar with butternuts. They are sure tasty, though. My gut is to try it and see if it fails, it fails. But I don't think I've seen one in an urban environment before.
Well,
right. Yeah. I would also wonder, it might vary from tree to tree. I have pretty limited knowledge with butternuts, but I'm sure we have people on our staff who are the wheels are turning and they're wondering that themselves. So I wish they were here on the call. I hope you try it and maybe something good will come out of it.
You know, I was thinking about, we used to have all kinds of chestnut trees in this country, and we kind of lost a big chunk of them years back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Chestnut bar or something.
Yeah.
The American. You want to take it, Jacob?
You did a great job talking about the history of black currants. Do you want to talk about chestnuts too? Because a lot of these crops have very interesting histories of how they were here, and we kind of knew how to use them and knew what to do with them, and then something happened and they became less common. And that's definitely true for chestnuts.
One of the big problems with perennial agriculture, and one of the the thing that keeps me in a job, is that trees don't know how to run. And so therefore diseases can really take them out. So the American chestnut was decimated by the chestnut blight. And that is a fungal disease that basically killed all these chestnuts that were native to the Americas. And it's a fungus that causes them to die back all the way to the ground, and then their root structures can survive, some of them, and they'll re-sprout, but it's really detrimental to nut production. So we don't have the American chestnuts anymore, really. There is efforts to bring them back through genetic engineering and breeding, and at the Savannah Institute, we are focusing primarily on Chinese chestnuts, which fills a similar ecological niche, but is resistant to the blight. So with this, you can get a successful berry crop. And when we're trying to get farmers to be able to grow stuff that will provide them livelihood, we are banking more on the side of things that have the resistance already built in, as opposed to trying to build it up from scratch through breeding. Yeah. But Chinese chestnuts are delicious. And it's so funny. They're hypothetically not as cold hardy as American chestnuts. And so we planted tens of thousands out in our farm in Spring Green, Wisconsin, to narrow down which ones were cold tolerant enough to survive in Wisconsin. And we planted them really tight, expecting like half of them to die. And unfortunately, the vast majority have survived.
So now you're going to have to
figure out what to do with them.
Yeah. Now you're going to have to move them.
It's great for a grower in Wisconsin, and that's not a lot of good science for us. So.
Oh, boy. Steve in Two Harbors. I think we're going back to currants with Steve. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Hi. How are you guys today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
I'm wondering if black currants would if I planted them in like canvas bags, if I could move them. I'm got a move coming up within a year, and but I still want to plant the black currants. So I'm wondering if I, you know, those bags you can buy, you know, that you put dirt in, and would that work on a black currant or not?
Yeah, absolutely. A black currant is going to really start producing, like, it's not going to fruit too much on first year wood, but if you plant something in a canvas bag and it's living there for a couple years, that's going to help it, like, build up its roots and start to really establish. And if you can get it in the ground within 3 years, you can probably get a pretty good crop off of it pretty quickly. I've seen people growing currants in containers just forever. You don't get as good of a yield if it's in a container, but it's certainly doable for the long term as well.
Ah, there you go, Steve. Thanks for calling. Glenn in Middleton, what's on your mind?
Well, thank you. A couple things. First, I have drunk currant juice. It's the most wonderful juice I've ever tasted. It's just tremendous. So I could recommend that to people. I don't know how much you got to pick in order to get a glass of juice, but it was bought at the store, and it was delicious. And then before I forget about butternut, I'm the emeritus professor of tree and forest health at UW. And butternut, I cannot recommend people to plant because it is subject to a lethal disease that has just about eliminated them from the wild. It's called butternut canker caused by a fungus. It got to the point that it was hard for me to even find butternuts to show them to students and show them the disease. Every time we'd find the butternuts, we'd find the disease. Sadly, Wisconsin used to have more butternut than any other state in the country, and they're just about gone. So anyway,
well,
and then, I have a comment about white pine blister rust because my major professor at UW-Madison spent his whole career working on white pine blister rust. It is not gone. It is a lethal disease of white pine. We're fortunate in that white pine is kind of rebounding in terms of natural regeneration. But if you have white pine, want to grow white pine, you do not want to have ribes, any of the ribes species that are native in Wisconsin, which there's 10 or 12 at least. They're not compatible with production of white pine. And I've even dealt with a small landowner who wondered why their white pines were dying, sent me a sample, and they had lined their driveways with ribes plants. And the blister rust is ubiquitous. It's even on ribes on the UW-Madison campus. So you really have to make your choice. Anybody who wants to grow white pine or grow white pine commercially or residentially, you do not want to have any of our ribes nearby. Now, the obvious goal would be to have resistance both within our native white pine or resistance within the ribes. But as far as I know, we do not have durable resistance in either yet.
Yeah, we have in black currants, there are resistant black currants to white pine blister rust. I don't like to say immunity because the white pine blister rust and the currant are both biological organisms and the fungus can adapt and figure out how to overcome our immunity. But there are a number of black currant varieties that don't seem to get it as much, though that's going to depend on the fungal strain. So like Savannah Zing and Savannah Zap are both resistant. They have a gene called the CR gene that seems to inhibit the spores being developed. I know you could also treat with mineral oil to keep spores from spreading, but yeah, the spores can really travel for thousands of feet in one direction and for hundreds of miles in the other direction, depending on what organism it's going from and going to.
Yeah. Glenn, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Johnny in Wausau has a different kind of thing going on here, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Johnny.
Hello. several years ago, over 40 years ago, my husband and I toured the International Peace Gardens in North Dakota in the spring, and I saw a bush that had the most beautiful fragrance and found out that it was a cinnamon currant. And so a few years after that, my husband found a nursery online where we could buy some cinnamon currants, and we have a beautiful cinnamon currant patch in our backyard. And I harvest the berries and dry them and make them in sweet breads, especially hot cross buns. They're terrific. About 5-6 years ago, we had really old potentilla bushes that we dug out. And so we divided the cinnamon currants and transplanted some stalks. My problem is that those stalks are still spindly. They will grow leaves, but I don't get much blossoms, and they haven't spread, and I don't get fruit.
Could be a lot of reasons for that, I suppose, Lily.
Yeah, there could be a couple of different reasons. The one that comes to my mind the most is fertilizing. Do you know how you're fertilizing those bushes?
No, we are not.
Okay. I know for, at least in my bushes, when I'm not getting flowers and fruit, it's because I'm under fertilizing.
So are you talking phosphorus? Are you talking nitrogen? Or are you
mostly nitrogen? Yeah, they're at least in Ribes nigrum. I'm not sure what cinnamon currant is in terms of the species name. Is it Lacustre or Aurum? I'm not sure. But in nigrum itself, you want like 100 pounds of nitrogen per acre if you're talking a farmer's field. So it wants a pretty heavy dosage of nitrogen. We're doing a fertilization trial right now in Ribes nigrum and black currant to see how much actually it needs, but that's the current recommendation, is 100 pounds per acre.
There you go, Johnny. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller with Jacob Grace and Lily Hislop for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Great to have you along today here on WPR News as we talk about the latest on growing perennial foods with our two guests from the Savannah Institute, Jacob Grace and Lily Hislop. Great to have them along. And again, join in with your own thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. You know, before time gets away from us and I forget about it, I know you have an event coming up in March that I did want to have you talk about. It's the Perennial Farm Gathering, March 11th through the 12th.
Yes, 11th through 13th, actually.
Oh.
But yeah, no, thanks for bringing this up. So we talked about a lot of different perennial crops today, and there are a lot of people growing these perennial crops all across the Midwest, but sometimes it's hard for them to find each other. So our Perennial Farm Gathering is a chance for people who are working with these crops to get together and share what they've learned. So our next Perennial Farm Gathering, like you said, is going to be March 11th through 13th. It's going to be in Dubuque, Iowa, so just over the river in Iowa. And our keynote speaker is going to be an Iowa farmer named Wendy Johnson, who is grew up on a family farm in Iowa and is doing a lot of different stuff on our farm with agroforestry and also with managed grazing and also with growing perennial grains. So those are all good examples of perennial agriculture and different ways that people can kind of get roots in the ground and improve their soil health. And then we're also going to be doing a book release event with an author named Liz Carlisle, who has edited a new collection of essays that's going to be coming out. It's called Living Roots, and it's writing by a bunch of different people across the country who are doing perennial agriculture, growing these crops, doing research. So we're going to be kind of kicking that off at the Perennial Farm Gathering. And if people want to learn more, they can go to the Savannah Institute website, which is savannahinstitute.org. And that's Savannah with no H. So hopefully you can find us there.
Okay. And it's cost. People need to sign up for it, I assume.
Yeah. You'll need to register in advance, but you can find all those details online.
And you mentioned earlier a podcast you guys are doing. Tell me some more about that podcast.
Yeah, so that's kind of my pet project is I like to have people on our podcast to just talk about things relating to agroforestry and perennial agriculture. So Lily's been on the podcast to talk about black currants. We have our most recent episode is talking to two researchers from UW-Madison about silvopasture by subtraction, which is something that people might be interested in. So this is if you have a poor quality woodland or a forest that needs some attention. Silvopasture by subtraction is kind of thinning that woodland and then adding pasture grasses or forages underneath so that it can be a place where you can have livestock and then also have trees overhead that can be used for timber or other purposes. So this kind of gets back to what I was saying is that there are a lot of different examples of agroforestry. It can look a lot of different ways. And we get into that in the podcast. So if people want to look into that more, they can look for the Savannah Institute podcast.
Savannah Institute podcast. Okay. Well, elderberries came up. I was going to ask you about elderberries earlier, Lily, but you're doing some work on elderberries as well.
Yeah. So the elderberry is a native bush crop to North America as well, Sambucus canadensis. And we're trying to develop varieties that are easier to harvest, that ripen around the same time, as opposed to, you know, ripening indeterminately across the entire bush, that stay on the bush until they're ready to harvest, things like that. Elderberries are interesting and delicious and healthful. I don't generally recommend that people eat them raw. I recommend that people process them into syrups or use heat on them to make sure that they have cyanogenic glucosides in them, which is like the same thing that's in apple seeds and why you're not supposed to eat a bunch of apple seeds. There's different levels, and the American version has less than the European version, and the ripe fruit has less than the roots, for example, but I still recommend people process it. And the vast majority of the elderberry cultivars that you can buy at nurseries are wild selections that people found in the woods or on their homesteads and went, this is great. We'll clone this and make this into a crop. And so I'm trying to do just generally the first layer of breeding of, I like this bush. It has big berries. I like this bush. It ripens all at the same time. Let's cross them together and see what we get.
That's cool. How long does it take for that whole process to work? I mean, you're not talking about 2 weeks later.
It's about 15 years to go from the first cross to a released product. It's a long time.
You're going to be a middle-aged woman by the time you get to talk about some of your results, although I imagine that you've got things going on all the time that you can...
Yeah, absolutely. The like black currant cultivars that we have through the Savannah Institute, we actually acquired a breeding program that had been going on for 20 years. A breeder named Richard McGinnis in British Columbia was looking to retire, and we were looking to start a breeding program. So that worked out really well. But because there hasn't really been much breeding done in elderberries, it's kind of me and Liz Pranger at Mizzou are kind of the two elderberry breeders that I know of in the United States. And I'm the only black currant breeder that I know of in North America who's institutionally backed. I think I'm the only one in the Western Hemisphere.
And that reminds me, somebody emails in about where did you say again, they can buy the black currant plants?
If you're looking to buy more than 25 plants or you and your neighbors are going in together, Canopy Nursery is a great place for wholesale perennial agriculture plants. If you're looking to buy maybe two varieties, I personally really like One Green World or Rain Tree Nursery are both very good. They produce great quality plants, and they have a really wide variety, especially of black currants and elderberries and other similar perennial fruit crops.
Steve in Bayfield County has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I wanted to let you know about what we've been working on in Bayfield County. We've been partnering with UW Extension and a gentleman named Jason Fishbach, who is been doing a lot of research with, most recently, he's been working with a table grape that would be grown in northern Wisconsin, but also his big research project over the last few years has been hazelnuts. And hazelnuts are native to northern Wisconsin or in Bayfield County, and there's been some real promising work being done now with that in our county. So just wanted to let you know about that.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. I've interviewed Jason more than once, but comment on that?
Yeah. Jason? Yep. Go ahead, Lily.
Jason Fishbach is really a brilliant guy and a delight to work with. The Savannah Institute is collaborating with him with the Upper Midwest Hazelnut Development Initiative. So we're trialing a bunch of different hazelnuts between Jason's work and Minnesota's work with our breeder, Scott Brainard, out in our farm at Spring Green.
Very, very cool. Had another email. How are you funded?
Oh, we are Jacob, you can take this one.
Sure. If you want details, we do have our version of an annual report, which we call our perennial report because we work in perennial agriculture. You can find all that on the website. But we're funded by a mix of public and private grants and then also through donations. So it really is a mix of sources, but a big chunk of it is through grants. And then because we are a nonprofit organization, we're also able to accept donations. And as for the details, I don't know as much about that, but that's the big picture.
That's the big picture. Yeah.
Yeah.
Lily,
it's really cool to be doing community supported research. My work is supported by things like sales of black currants, such as Savannah Zing and Savannah Zap, and individual donations. And I do a lot of work with local farmers doing participatory breeding, where I give them plants and let them evaluate them, because ultimately they're the people who are going to be working with whatever cultivars I produce. So their opinion matters just as much as mine. And it's really great to work with these farmers and get their support in that way.
Yeah. What's the future look like for the Savannah Institute? I mean, there's thinking about all cuts and this and that have gone on. I mean, are you feeling healthy yourself?
I think we're pretty fortunate, again, being a nonprofit organization, that we have kind of a diverse source of funding, so that if certain funding sources go away, we have others that we can lean on a little bit more. And we definitely feel for some of our partners who are feeling those cuts a little bit more directly, and that is impacting our work, that some of these collaborations are not moving as fast as they might have been at another time. But we still really care about what we're doing, and we have funders and donors who really care about what we're doing. So we're excited to keep it up. And as Lily has talked about, working with these crops is a long-term proposition. If you're going to be trying to breed and improve tree crops, that's, we're planting things now that are hopefully going to outlive us. So that's kind of something that I appreciate about our work, is that it gets me thinking out into the future and hoping for good things.
Well, you both have no shortage of enthusiasm, and I love that. I want to thank you both for being with us today. It was a great hour and a great chance to talk with you, and I'm sure we'll be getting updates down the line from you as well. Thanks, Lily. Thanks,
Jacob.
Thank
you so much, Larry.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be here.
Jacob Grace and Lily Hislop are both with the Savannah Institute. It was fun learning about all the work going on with trees and food trees and with currants as well, especially black currants. Great to have them with us, and great to have you listening in today. On Monday, we're going to talk with the author of our latest book club book of the year. It's titled A Measured Thread. I just finished reading it, and I really like it. And I know you will, too. So tune in on Monday for that. And big thanks to our whole team, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller.